I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Today on the show, journalist and food conscience Michael Pollan gets us tuned in to what's possible in how we feed ourselves. Dumplings aren't just found in Chinese food. Many other cuisines have them. And legendary cookbook author and food personality Marcella Hazan is here. Plus, it's your chance to support Good Food in KCRW and get the opportunity to win an Apple computer or a professional knife set. But first, let's see what's fresh and in season this week at the area farmers markets.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. I'm visiting with Evan Funke, who is the chef over at Rustic Canyon, which is a wonderful restaurant right here in Santa Monica, just blocks from the market. Evan and his pastry chef for the restaurant, Zoe Nathan, and of course owner Josh Loeb are here every week shopping at the market. And Evan, we love to catch up with you chefs, find out what's on your list and what you're going to be cooking from the market.
Right now, I'm seeing kind of a strange market, kind of in transition, but what I have been seeing is some beautiful artichokes from Life's a Choke. And what I like to do with these, they're so tender and so beautiful, these purple artichokes, is
do
them.
The little ones or the big ones?
The little ones, okay. Yes. I like to use these small purples in a dish I had in Rome on the street. They call them Jewish ghetto Roman style artichokes.
Yeah.
Basically what they do, they kind of chop the top off and then smush them down into a flat surface so they become kind of flowers. And then they fry them in olive oil or pork fat if you're in Bologna. Or
like they're totally submerged, they're deep fried.
Deep fried,
okay.
Absolutely. And then they toss them with hot olive oil, garlic, and parsley. And they're fantastic. A little squeeze of lemon over the top. Absolutely glorious.
Now, how do you squish them down? You're not trimming any outer leaves. You're not
you just want to trim the outer leaves. Just pull them off because they're very, very tender.
Okay.
Just the outer rim.
Okay.
And then clip off the top so it's flat. And then invert it and smush it down into a cutting board or something like that, and it'll open up like a flower.
Okay, and the choke is so little at this point, you don't have to worry about the choke,
Not at all.
You cut the stem off so it's flat, right?
The stem off,
okay.
Yes, exactly.
Right. Then you get a flat flower, and then you, how do you know when they're done, when you're deep frying?
They're going to get very crisp. They're going to get dark because they are purple, so just kind of have to feel it out, really.
Would you say under 5 minutes?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
These are going to cook very fast because they're so tender right now.
Uh-huh.
They're going to cook for maybe a minute and a half to 2 minutes in some hot oil, about 350 degrees.
Do you have to flip them over, or they're just submerged?
They're just going to be submerged, just like
right.
that. They serve them on the street. It's like Italian version of street food.
Do they just hand it to you in a greasy piece of paper, and
absolutely.
You just chow down?
I've had them in newspaper. I've had them in parchment paper. I've had them in a paper sack.
Or your bare hand.
Or a little too hot, but
right.
Yes.
And those are available. You've seen them at the Phil Green, Life's a Choke.
Absolutely.
And they're the small purple. Have you tried it with a small green, or you're just crazy about the purple artichokes?
I'm crazy about the purple. They're so tender and so nice. There's no choke inside. They're all heart.
Like you. Okay.
Thank you very much.
All right, Evan. Well, that sounds delicious. And anything that has to do with greasy street food or street food in general, it's always good. And
yeah,
Rustic
right.
Canyon is going on now. You don't do the brunch anymore. We're still sad about
we transfer
that.
Transfer that to Huckleberry.
Oh, Huckleberry will do the brunch.
Yeah, this is Zoe's baby.
Okay. And then so now these two restaurants are located basically side by side.
It's down the street from each other, diagonally.
And it's on Wilshire and what?
Wilshire and 10th.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
All right, good. And they're across the street.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, we're dashing across traffic to get
dashing
them.
Across traffic for pastries.
Okay, sounds good. And so, but Rustic Canyon's open lunch and dinner?
Just dinner.
Just dinner.
Seven nights a week.
Okay, great. And we'll find you on the website and Huckleberry mid-February. So exciting. Thanks so much, Evan.
Thank you so much.
That was Evan Funke. Clearly, he's an aficionado of good food and street food, and these baby artichokes you can find here at the farmer's market as well. This time of year is a great time to be checking out all the citrus varieties we have at the market. Of course, tangerines have been in since about December, but the multiple varieties of different kinds of tangerines we have are always worth checking out. And Troy Regeer is a citrus grower from Reedley. He also comes in the summer with delicious peaches and nectarines. But right now, Troy, you got your satsumas, and now you've got another really tasty clementine.
Yeah, satsumas are coming to an end, maybe one or two more weeks of them, and then we have clementines right now that we're just starting, and they really have a full flavor. Satsumas are a little more sweet, a little more mild, but sweeter, easier to peel, but the clementines and some of the murcots that are going to be coming up are just packed with flavor. It's really a good choice during the winter. Kids love that, and they really go for it.
The only difference is, I guess, in the easiness of peeling. are one of the main differences?
Yeah, the clementines are a little harder to peel, but not too bad versus the satsumas. And I think the murcots, you know, they're pretty much the same as the clementines, but more and more people are asking for clementines, and that's why we planted them about 3 or 4 years ago. And it just takes so long for a tree to produce. It takes about 6 to 8 years before you get a good crop on a citrus tree. And we do let things get ripe on the tree.
Right.
So that's what's nice about the farmer's market is everything is ripe and ready to go versus the grocery store.
Absolutely. And they're fresh, like you said.
Very fresh. Very we usually fresh. Pick them the day before we come.
All right, Troy. Well, thanks again.
All right. Thank you.
That was Troy Regeer, and he's a tangerine and a peach grower. And he comes down from Reedley, and he's been coming here for many, many years. His fruit is always delicious. Well, we all know it's tough times out there, and the economic downturn is probably affecting us in ways we can't even begin to imagine. But at times like this, it's really important to kind of refocus and regroup and really consider what's important in our lives. And if you've got that radio station programmed on KCRW and you rely on it morning, noon, and night, 7 days a week, and of course Saturday mornings at 11, we're hoping that you're going to pick up the phone right now. Make that pledge. Pledge whatever you can. It's really important, especially now, to keep the important things in life in your life. So please join me in supporting the radio station. And thank you so much for listening and for supporting the radio station. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Check out what Laura Avery just talked about at kcrw.com/goodfood. Every generation has its truth teller, its sage. Our sage on all things edible is Michael Pollan. The journalist and author of books like The Omnivore's Dilemma is who we turn to for updates on policy that affects our lives. That's coming up next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. At Good Food, we've invited Michael Pollan to look forward with us to the future of food in 2009 and beyond. So do you have a crystal ball for me, Mr. Pollan?
Well, it's pretty cloudy, but I've got one. you know, there are a lot of kind of contradictory cross currents out there. I mean, at the one hand, you have people as passionate about food and eating sustainably as any time I can remember. On the other hand, you've got people lacking the resources to do so more than, you know, has been true in the past. And you see companies like Whole Foods are struggling and the growth of organics has slowed. Although considering, it's remarkable that it's still growing and growing quickly, but not as fast as it was. So I think that there's a tension that's been set up between people's aspirations for food and the reality of the economic situation. You look at two of the great winners in you know, that are still make companies still making lots of money and reporting good results to Wall Street, and there you see McDonald's and Walmart. You know, this is the industrial food system. This is the bottom end of the food system, and people are trading down, which is, you know, very sad and but perhaps understandable.
So much about what you've written lately is the link between our degraded ecology and our food system. So much of the resources our food system in its industrialized state uses are precisely those resources that we would like not to use so much of.
I think that's right. And I think that there are very strong arguments you can make that to achieve the goals that President Obama has set for himself, which is to say to address our oil independence, to address climate change, to address the public health crisis, the one thing you can do that will help you make progress on all those issues is to reform the food system. Because food contributes about, you know, a quarter of greenhouse gases. The way we're eating is responsible for more than $250 billion in healthcare costs because of all the chronic diseases that are linked to diet. And, you know, the amount of fossil fuel, it's 20% of our fossil fuel bill goes into the way we're feeding ourselves. And whether Obama really has the appetite to push the issue, to push any issue of reform, remains to be seen. So far, his cabinet picks suggest that he really wants to leave the large bureaucracies of Washington more or less intact. On the other hand, there is this mounting popular pressure to change the food system, and there are these very good reasons to do it. And I think that, though, as citizens, we shouldn't, and especially for those citizens who did support Obama, we shouldn't sit back and assume that because he's like-minded, he is going to have an agenda or implement an agenda that we like. He needs us at his back, which is to say encouraging and pressuring him to move in the direction we want to see him move.
And there will be another cycle of farm and food bill coming
yes.
up, hopefully, during his tenure.
But even before that, take a look at the school lunch program, which has to get reauthorized right away, and look for signs of reform there. Are we going to genuinely, as Vilsack, the new head of USDA, or a nominee, said that he was going to put nutrition at the center of food assistance programs. That, you know, sounds like a no-brainer, but it would be radical for the Department of Agriculture, which really puts disposing of its surpluses at the heart of its nutrition programs. So let's see what happens with the with school lunch. And I think that that is a very telling case, and because there's so much that could be done there, not only to improve the health of the nation's children, but to drive the development of local food economies by making it easier for school districts to buy food locally, real food, fresh food, and not the kind of processed commodity junk that is generally passes for food in the school lunch program.
And what about ethanol? Do you think the days of ethanol being based on a food product are going to wane?
Yeah, I think they're over. I mean, you know, corn-based ethanol is kind of in its Wile E. Coyote moment. It's kind of, you know, racing off the cliff and is in air, and it hasn't looked down yet. But it's about to look down. I mean, the industry is collapsing. We have seen worldwide the terrible price that turning our farmland into a way to feed our SUVs has exacted on the world's poor and on our food economy, too. I mean, it is, according to the World Bank, not me, but it is responsible for between 30% and 40% of the run-up in food prices over the last year. I take as hopeful the fact that although Obama has himself supports corn-based ethanol, and of course it's something you have to do as a senator from Illinois, and his Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack, is an ardent supporter of corn-based ethanol, take a look at his Secretary of Energy, Stephen Chu, who is scathing in his dismissal of corn-based ethanol as a serious option. You know, if you want to move away from corn-based ethanol, a really good way to do it is to have your Nobel Prize-winning Secretary of Agriculture tell you it's a bad idea. And I think that's exactly what we're going to see happen in the next few months. Now, of course, we may replace it with something just as bad or worse, but I think we will get off of corn-based ethanol and soon.
See, now I feel better.
You know, it's the best of times and it's the worst of times, but it is the most interesting times.
Absolutely. Thank you. It's always an interesting time to have a conversation with you.
Thank you. Likewise, Evan.
Michael Pollan is a journalist and author of several books, including The Omnivore's Dilemma. I'm taking one last time to pitch you a bit. I'm not selling you a Ginzu knife or a Snuggie, but I am selling you on a concept, supporting public radio. Right now at KCRW, we're wrapping up our winter pledge drive. I know it's hard to believe, but this is actually how we fund our operation, by convincing listeners like you to pay for something that you can get for free. I hope you'll agree that good food is worth a few bucks. It's amazing what happens when lots of people get together and chip in a small amount of money. So for as little as $5 a month, you can do a good thing today by funding this program. Your dollars help pay for studio time, engineers, producers, and the bandwidth that we use to distribute the show to you. Think of it like $1.25 per podcast. That's not too bad. Go to kcrw.com/join now. You'll be entered automatically into a one-of-a-kind trip to the Australian outback, plus a chance to win the new Jetta TDI Clean Diesel. Good Food subscribers have a chance to win a 7-piece professional Wusthof knife set. That's just our way of saying thanks. Remember, as little as $5 a month will make an incredible difference to us here and allow us to bring you the stories that you hear each week. Thanks for your time. Now back to the show. Dumplings are like little gifts. They're collections of flavor wrapped up in some kind of edible dough. And while we associate dumplings with Chinese cuisine, you'll be pleasantly surprised to hear that many other cuisines have dumplings too. I'll be back with Chef Susan Feniger to taste a few. That's next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Dumplings, those homey, fat mouthfuls of dough filled with, well, just about anything, are an international food. Nearly every culture has a dumpling. Susan Feniger, well-known chef, is about to embark on a new venture, and dumplings are at its heart. Hi, Susan.
Hey. Yes.
So your place, Street, is going to have a whole section that's nothing but dumplings, I understand.
It's going to be dumplings. It's dumplings and tea cake. So it's from all different parts of the world, different small appetizers that are focused mainly on dumplings and little cakes of some sort. You know, the most challenging thing, Evan, has been to try to limit what you do because you start to, when you're starting to look all over the world, you don't even know where to stop. You
and
really
don't. And
especially
when you're developing a concept, like you've been in development mode for a while now, you get so excited by everything.
You do. You know, we've been in there experimenting, playing with all these different ideas. So, I mean, one of the dumplings we're doing, because this is a dumpling that's, say, from the streets of India, which is this ura dal, which is a black bean dal fritter. And basically, you take black bean dal, the inside of the bean, and you grind it and let it sit overnight, and it ferments. And then you, the next day, you drop it in hot oil, and it puffs up and you get this crispy dumpling, this crispy fritter, and then it gets soaked in a homemade yogurt, say with a tamarind chutney and a mint cilantro chutney.
This is so up my alley.
I know that. I mean, it's just the most delicious thing. Or, for an example, you know, we're doing these Cuban potatoes, the papa relleno, which is a very Latin dish, and it's, you know, potato. And it's got in its stuffing a ground beef that basically has raisins and olives.
Like
and
a little picadillo.
Exactly. And it's, you know, then that's fried and it's served with a, you know, a tomato mint sauce. So that's, you know, sort of a Latin version of a dumpling.
You're going to have to do what all the Asian restaurants do. In between lunch and dinner, you always see the wait staff putting together all the dumplings.
It's true. Exactly. Well, between lunch and dinner, we really want to sort of have it be this sort of afternoon tea time. There's that great outdoor patio there with a fire pit. So we sort of imagine we could have this great afternoon. You could sit outside. We're going to have a really interesting selection of teas. There's going to be pulled teas, which is done, you know, and you see it on the streets of Malaysia where someone has a pot of tea and they're pulling it and sort of going back and forth between two pots. So we're going to have, you know, a really interesting selection of green teas, obviously black teas, and then...
Have you started the training for the tea pouring?
No.
That will be really
hysterically
funny.
I've been practicing it. It is very fun. I know. We tried it at the house the other day and, you know, tried to let someone else experiment. It ended up half on the floor.
Of course.
In the kitchen. Yeah, I know. It's very, very interesting.
It's good to be ambitious.
I have to tell you about this one dish we're doing, which is this Sasha, who's the executive chef and also going to be a partner in the restaurant. Her mother's from China. So we've been making dishes, and then we have her try them. And, of course, she gives us like, no, we would never do that, you know, and then we do it anyways. But we're doing this daikon radish cake that is just – it's a rice and daikon radish cake. And – traditionally, it's with rice flour and grated radish, and it's filled with whatever you want to fill it. We're going to be filling it with the Chinese sausage and whatever spices. And then it goes into a lined pan with saran wrap and steamed, and it comes out as a cake. And then you slice it, and then just brown it in a little bit of butter. And of course, one of my favorite things is to have like a fried egg on top of it. But that's going to be served during that time. So it's this steamed, you know, sort of Cantonese radish, daikon radish cake that is just absolutely delicious.
Are you going to be doing like a dim sum brunch or anything like
that? Well, we are going to do brunch on Sundays. And so there's going to be, you know, a brunch menu. And then obviously a lot of the dumplings will be on that menu too.
So is your main focus for the dumplings Asia?
On the menu that we've sort of played with so far, we're looking at, yes, there's going to be, you know, there'll be this Korean dumpling that's vegetarian that has these sweet potato noodles stuffed into it. There's going to be a pork dumpling, like people are very traditionally, that's really wonderful with this orange. We've been playing with cardamom and orange zest in it that is just delicious. So there's sort of that version. Then we're going to be doing, like I said, like these Chinese sort of these sesame cakes. This is another version that's really quite yummy that's made with the glutinous rice flour, and it's stuffed with an azuki red bean paste coated in sesame seeds. So there's going to be that as sort of a dumpling.
So are you having to create new relationships with different vendors?
For sure. That's been unbelievable. Going to some of these markets where honestly you walk through a certain, you know, market and you have no idea what you're looking at. None whatsoever. I mean, we've had to go shopping like a couple times with Sasha's mother to understand what the products are. It's really been challenging.
It's one of my favorite things, and that is you never stop learning.
Honestly, Evan, this has been very eye-opening because it is very expansive, very educational, just learning about different products. But it's one of the fabulous things about cooking. The challenge is you taste something when you're out, and then you think, okay, how is it made, and how do you make it better? You know, I mean, you know how it is. You'll taste something and you get inspiration from it. But what you want to try to do is how do you make it better than that?
I can't wait to taste. Thank you, Susan.
Thank you very much.
The Street is Susan Feniger's solo venture. The restaurant is slated to open in March. It's located kitty corner to Moza at Highland and Melrose. Maybe you don't know this about me yet, but I'm an adopted Italian. I adopted myself into the culture, the language, the cuisine. Some people enabled me along the way. The godmother of Italian cuisine, Marcella Hazan, not only schooled me on the ways of Italian food, but she also taught the entire country. I'm lucky to have her in the studio with me next. That's coming up on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. I just become besotted with the culinary culture of Italy and was cooking from memory when my mother gave me Marcella Hazan's first book, The Classic Italian Cookbook. As I created my own world of Italian food in Los Angeles, Marcella was firmly by my side. In a world of no Italian parsley or fresh basil in the supermarkets, I knew I could create what I remembered of Italy in the Los Angeles of the early 70s. I wasn't alone. Marcella Hazan opened the world of Italian food traditions to American home cooks. Her memoir, Amarcord, Marcella Remembers, reveals the surprisingly quirky road she traveled to become the queen of Italian food of the English-speaking world. With her in the studio this morning is Victor Hazan, noted wine writer, Marcella's husband and collaborator. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you. Thank you, Evan.
Marcella, you've led such a remarkable life with many twists and turns. It seems that you first learned about food and learned to cook under the stress of the war and the German occupation.
Oh, well, that was very difficult because aside the bomb, they were coming down constantly because unfortunately, we chose a place to be where we were very near, 3 miles only, from the head commander of Germany for Italy. And 2 miles from Mussolini went after he was rescued from prison by the German. So the alley, they were bombarding all the time. And the food was very scarce. It was impossible to find salt. You know, salt, you think that is very common thing. It doesn't cost almost nothing. But during the war, it was one of the most precious things. But, you know, it was a very, very strange way of living. It was not really at all a normal living. Because when we were eating, we were not sitting at the table with the leg under the table. We were sitting sideways. And sideways facing the door that took us to the shelter. Because when the bomb arrived, the airplane, we could run out without losing any time. But if by any chance we didn't have time because the bomb was coming down already, we were taking the dish and go under the table, but with the dish, because in the dish was the food. And keep it on the table. It was ruined by the plaster that was coming down from the ceiling from vibration of the bomb. So it was always very strange. You know, it was a completely different life.
Now, you met Victor when you were in your university days. How did his influence affect the way that you saw food?
Until I met him, I never thought about food. I was not interested in food, and I was just eating, that's all. But Victor was always talking about food, darling, and he started telling me what he had for lunch, explaining every dish. And after, he was telling me what he wanted to have for dinner. And you know, for a young woman, in love with this man, but having this man talk all the time about food, I thought it was very strange. It was not really romantic. And but, you know, that was Victor. And I loved it anyway. We came to America, and I never had to cook anything for human, you know. And I have this young man that food was so important for him, and I had to start cooking. And I didn't have anyone that I knew aside him in America, and I didn't know one word of English. Victor naturally took me first thing in the supermarket because so I could buy ingredient to cook. And the supermarket, I never saw one before. It was very strange. It was, everything was dead there. Everything was wrapped in a coffin. I never saw a chicken so dead in my life before. And the vegetable, they were wrapped, everything looked not real. And me, that I knew so little about food, it was really a problem. The only problem I didn't have that I could buy without knowing one word of English because I just look at the price and give the money. But you know what? I think that I didn't know that by osmosis almost, I had collect memory of the smell of the food that I was eating. In Italy, when I was young, not married, the look of the food, the texture of the food, the taste of the food. So at that point, I have to look something to help me to cook. And those memories came out little by little and helped me to do dishes.
Marcella Hazan is the well-known author of many cookbooks on Italian food. Her latest book is a memoir called Amarcord, Marcella Remembers. Hey, what about becoming a fan of me? Evan Kleiman, K-L-E-I-M-A-N, on Facebook. We've got some contests to win some of the books we feature there and other great things to see. We've got a brand new feature on our site, too. You can add a comment about today's show on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. Tell us what you think. I hope you'll contribute today to KCRW. Go to kcrw.com/join for as little as $5 a month. Jennifer Farrow is the executive producer of Good Food. The show is produced by Harriet Ells, Connie Alvarez, Holly Tarson, Bob Carlson, and Candace Moyer. Gary Macias, our music supervisor. Meet me here next week for another edition of Good Food.